Today is Tuesday, September 9th, 2019. You're listening to the Geekdom Fireside Chat Series. Recorded live at the Geekdom Event Center in downtown San Antonio, Texas. This month's guest is Katie Quinn, CEO and founder of Deer Duck. Let's join the founder of Startup San Antonio and moderator Iris Gonzalez for this month's Geekdom Fireside Chat.
Good evening, Geekdom. Hey, thanks for coming out tonight. I think you're going to find this to be an intriguing interview because I know things you don't know right now, but you're going to know it in an hour. Now, I am thrilled to be here tonight because I get to invite Katie Quinn, who is the founder and CEO of Deer Duck. It's a B2B SaaS platform. What does that mean? B2B, business to business. SaaS is software as a service. It's a company that helps make shopping on every website fun and social. She worked as a tech consultant for companies such as Ernst & Young and the Shell Oil Company. And then during her tenure at Ernst & Young, she worked closely with retailers such as Walmart because they were looking to change their digital relationship with customers. She led some cross-application security projects to improve the efficiencies for a number of Fortune 500 companies, with Walmart being her main focus. I know that sounds like corporate, you know, language, but that means that she has worked at really high levels. How do you hack companies dealing with their customer base, which is very valuable knowledge? She holds a BA in accounting with a minor in internal audit from LSU. You're going to discover tonight that she also has some rather unique expertise and skills. Her understanding of relationship psychology and her technical background led her to create a solution, a unique solution. Her mission is to make it easy to reach each of us in order to build meaningful relationships. She left the corporate world in 2015 to start Deer Duck. So I hope you can join me in welcoming Katie to Geekdom tonight to talk about her company, Deer Duck.
Thank you, Iris.
So you're making good money, working in the corporate world. Oh, come on.
I thought you meant today. I was like, woo.
No, not today. In the past, in a long time ago, in a place far away.
A long time ago.
You were in the corporate world. And yes. Then what moved you to leave that cushy job in 2015 to become a startup founder?
I still ask myself that. No, I'm just kidding. There were a number of things that drove me to leave the corporate world. And I think the first step was I was at Ernst & Young, as you mentioned, for a while after college. And I learned a lot. I was working a lot. It was pretty much nonstop. I was traveling almost 100%. And I got a call from one of my bosses who actually helped recruit me from college to join Ernst & Young. And he said, how would you feel about becoming an independent consultant? And my dad worked for Exxon just to kind of paint a picture of the world I was used to. Very secure, very, you know, you work for the same company your entire life. He started at Exxon when he was an intern and is still there today. So this was not something that was really on my radar as far as becoming an independent consultant. It was kind of the first step towards instability, but I loved my job. I left and started doing that. It was the first time that I kind of had to figure out, how do I do the health insurance thing? How do I, you know, make sure that I always have projects? And one of the most interesting things with that first role was that I had a lot of time on my hands. I was only able to work 40 hours a week. So I went from being very, very busy, traveling 100% with Ernst & Young, to making more money, but also only working 40 hours a week and really figuring a lot out on my own. I was working for myself, essentially. So I had a lot of time to think and to create things. And I had seen so much when I was working with Walmart. And I also have been passionate about consumer, I call it consumer DNA, but why we like what we like and what makes us make the decisions as consumers, like down to little bitty details. And so I started putting these two things together as far as how I think as a consumer and how I think about what other people like and a lot of the problems that I saw in my spare time.
In your spare time? You didn't sleep?
Well, I was only working 40 hours a week at this point. Oh. So I went from working probably 70 hours a week and traveling all the time. So I was either on a flight or, you know, I was busy. I like being busy. And so I had, I was only, yeah. I was,
well, if you like being busy, being a startup founder is certainly a great way to
yeah.
overcome that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, so kind of fast forward, I started putting these ideas together in this PowerPoint and I was spending, a lot of time researching, what solutions were out there. And there was a woman, her name is Marcy Zlotnick. She, lives in Houston and she sold an energy company, a couple of years before 2015. So I think 2013. And I decided I was going to reach out to her and ask her if she wanted to go to coffee. And I had no idea what I was doing. I showed up. She agreed to go to coffee with me. She was a little bit intrigued. I didn't really know what I was working on yet. So that conversation was interesting. But I showed up, and I'm not kidding. I wish I was. I brought a stack of research. I don't know why. I don't know if I thought we were going to go through this research or not. I brought that to breakfast and I just started talking and she slowed me down about 15 minutes in and said, "Where are you from?" It was like, you know, pause. And I think she realized that she wanted to help me in some way. And so she gave me one piece of homework after that. And I was still working as a consultant. And she said, make an email address for this company that you aren't sure what it looks like and you have no name for it. And then never email me from your other email address again. And at that point, I realized I didn't want to let Marcy down. I wanted to make progress and to do something that would be exciting. And so I left. I made that email address in the parking lot of the restaurant that we met. And
what was the email address?
It was called... It's embarrassing. This is like, what was your AOL screen name? You know, I feel like this is one of those questions. It was theregistryclub@gmail.com.
It's a good start.
It's a start, I will say that.
It's a good start. It's a good start.
Yeah, and so I emailed her, and she said, I think she was in the bathroom. She, like, left the... She paid the bill. She went to the bathroom, and it was, like, we met at 7:30 in the morning. So I went back to my car. I sat there before I drove to work and made the email address, and she still tells this story. She goes, I wasn't even out of the restaurant yet, and she had already emailed me.
So... Tell me a little bit about your original approach when you first launched, about your attempts at trying to understand consumer DNA.
Yeah, I'll kind of fast forward to when we launched our B2B business this past November. So we had a lot of learnings that led up to that. But what we ultimately got, the product that we ultimately rolled out in November was a way to engage users from a business point of view. So if you, backing up, it was...
Start
at the beginning. We'll be here all night if I start.
Well, because, spoiler alert. She pivoted. She's pivoting big time. And you hear about pivots, and it's kind of like the eye of the hurricane. You don't know anybody who survived that experience, but you know it exists. And so here is someone who's in the eye of the hurricane and surviving and navigating beautifully, because it is Katie, a pivot. But I need you to talk about what you originally, your original concept, knowing that you've already pivoted.
Absolutely. So and I will say most companies pivot, but we don't know what was before. And so it's fun to learn that piece of the puzzle. When we first launched, we were consumer facing, and we were focused on gifting. So we, you know, if you think about like which type of wine would someone love, or if you're picking out, you know, you're kind of like staring at this wall, trying to narrow down a choice for someone based on their preferences. And the way that this kind of consumer DNA exists today is very much businesses can under, you know, they take our data, they're watching our every move, and they're applying it. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But there's no really place where as people or as consumers, we can go to discover this data, these preferences of people that we care about. And not only is there not a place to find these preferences, but most certainly not to apply that data as well. And so that's what we did. We people would take a survey and share their preferences in different categories. Those preferences would tie to products. And whenever you wanted to find something for someone else, you would basically search within a consumer portal. And then that evolved very quickly to, we realized businesses also needed this. And so in November, that was what we launched with, was a way to help people buy for others, originating from a business.
So now it's pivoted from a B2C to B2B, pure B2B. Does it have a new concept, a new name?
So in November, at that point where we were, we introduced a segment called BFO Marketing. So today, traditionally, all marketing had been done to an individual to buy for themselves. And so we realized that 30% of the time people are buying for someone else. And so we were focused very specifically on that 30% when people are actually buying for someone else.
So hence BFO, buying for others.
Yep.
So in other words, it's something that we all do, but she was the first one to actually call it something and recognize that it's a big segment of consumer activity.
Yeah, it's a big segment of a consumer activity. And it also, we started realizing that because people buy for others so often, the data is messy out there as far as who brands think that we are and what we like. And I've told this story many times, as some of you may have heard it, but my boyfriend, or my fiance now, he bought me a pair of yoga pants, and this retailer kept emailing him as if he wears yoga pants. And like, you know, it was like, these butt-busting yoga pants would look great on you, Sean. And so that's just an example of how it's not only a market that was being missed, but that is muddying the waters a little bit.
Right. So, okay, let's go back a little bit. I don't think people may realize you moved here from Houston.
Yes, I did last April.
Last April. Why did you move from Houston to here?
The traffic. No, I'm kidding.
Okay. I agree. But no, there's got to be another reason.
Yeah. Geekdom Fund has an accelerator here, or works with an accelerator, RealCo. And I was introduced to RealCo probably February of last year. And we were going through a big transition. I had finally learned what a cap table was and like these startup terms that, you know, I had finally learned how to kind of navigate the startup world and how to begin. And then we started transitioning to B2B. So I had to completely learn this whole new world all over again. And when I met RealCo, it just kind of clicked as their long-term accelerator, and they're really there. It takes longer than 3 months, which is what a lot of accelerators are focused on. And so they're there with you through the whole process.
So RealCo is a long-term accelerator program that's located here within Geekdom. And just as Katie was saying, you know, most programs are 3 months. This is more of like a year and a half.
Yeah.
Sometimes longer.
Sometimes longer.
Basically, they kick you out when you're ready. And,
yeah.
You know, and at that point, you don't need an accelerator anymore.
Right, exactly. It's very tailored to what each company needs. And every company is different. Some are, you know, it just takes longer and are different, you know, you need different things at different times.
Okay, so to recap, so you suddenly had free time on your hands. came up with an idea for a company because there's you identified a marketing approach that really people had not understood, mm-hmm. Made up a big segment of consumer activity, right?
Right.
Started the company in Houston. Then you were enticed to leave Houston and move here and join RealCo.
Yes. And I will say you didn't have to move. So I came my first week.
Ah,
right.
That's a good point to make.
And I still joke with them about this. I came for kickoff week and it was awesome. Like for me to be able to turn around in the office and ask questions and the mentors were right there was really valuable to me. And so I drove home and thought about it, I talked to Sean and I said, you know, I think this would be very valuable for me, for us to move here and for me to be in person and have help whenever, you know, all day, every day. And so it was kind of, it's kind of become a joke that I called RealCo right after that and said, I'm moving so I can work with you all the time.
Okay, so here's a question that's not on my list. Do you still show up to meetings with a big stack of research when you're asking for help from someone?
I don't. I don't.
Okay, good. Just checking. So what were you hearing from your earliest customers? This is in the early days of Dear Doc.
So I moved to San Antonio, and we were going through this big pivot to start focusing on B2B. And the first step of that, my advisors in RealCo and the people I was working with daily, they said, you have to sell something. And at that, like, that's going to be your first step. And at that point, we weren't sure exactly what we would be selling. And so it's something that I've learned is, I thought that was crazy, but it's pretty normal. I think a lot of companies end up in that spot. I had a meeting with now one of our customers, and I was talking about the problems that businesses face and how we were attacking that from this kind of emotional consumer level. And she said, we'll buy it. How much? And I didn't know what the product really looked like yet that we were going to be delivering. And so I just kind of blurted out a number that made sense based on the cost that I could, you know, figure out, that I had thought through that it would take. I went back and we just worked through it and we figured it out and we got something out the door. And the first goal that we had was based on how many profiles did we think we could, or how many profiles did we expect to see within the first month of rolling out with this customer. I think that number was around 1,000. And within the first 3 weeks, we passed 8,000. And that was kind of the first turning point for us to realize that the metric, yeah.
You were onto something.
We were onto something, yeah.
Something undiscovered.
Yeah, and other metrics that we started seeing, it wasn't just, I have goosebumps right now because that wasn't even a year ago, and it's crazy to think about. We were so focused on the users creating profiles. We thought that that was like our big number. But the interactions that we started seeing between consumers was what was probably the biggest surprise for us. And just to kind of paint a picture, normal email open rates for businesses, they're around 10%.
This is like marketing emails.
Marketing emails, 10 to 17%, depending on the industry. Ours were on like within this first 3 weeks that we started seeing this profile growth, users were able to open emails for each other to learn more about each other and to see what they have in common. And those were starting in the 60 percentile range, and they've gone up since. They continue to go up. We're now in the 70s.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
So just to understand a little bit, so you're building, it sounds to me like you're building a powerful algorithm then.
Yes.
You don't have to tell me proprietary stuff, just in general. So deep machine learning.
Yeah, we use AI.
And AI.
We're the first company to focus on consumer behavior, or behavior between consumers. So we can identify kind of basically like relationship strengths based on similarities or actions that people take for one another in specific industries. And it's super interesting.
It's a very interesting application of AI, you know, and everyone talks about, you know, the rise of the intelligent machines and it's going to eliminate our jobs. And I think what we're finding is that there's all these incredible applications to using AI to really look at lots of data, even the messy data,
yeah,
and try to come up with some interesting insights from it. And in this particular case, it's, you know, consumer behavior and relationships between consumers.
Right.
Right, so that Sean doesn't keep getting unsolicited emails about
yoga pants. You should have worn them tonight.
No. No, no. Okay, so last year was a big year for you. I mean, you know, you move here, you get started, you start getting your first clients. What happened at the end of 2018? You got some news, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. So at the end of 2018, we had applied for Techstars the year before that, and it wasn't the right timing. We were in the middle of such a big shift that we weren't really sure who we were at that time. So I got a call from Techstars and said, hey, we've been following you and we think it's the right time for you and think you could benefit from this. And the difference between what we were looking for with Techstars, it's a short program. It's 3.5 months. And it's focused on different things than we were getting from RealCo. And so the two together for me were kind of like gold. So we started the Techstars program in January this year. Yeah.
So, okay, everyone hears about Techstars. What you go into the program, it's in Austin.
It was in Austin, yeah.
What was the biggest surprise? You know, you have preconceived notions of what it's like to go through Techstars.
Oh, yeah.
What was, like, the biggest surprise right off the bat of, like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be like at all?
A lot of things. I think the biggest surprise for me was growth as a founder. Starting a company is hard, and every day is hard. Every day is challenging, and it's easy to, you're by yourself a lot, whether you're leading a team or not. You know, like, even if you're with a team and you're leading a team, it's a lonely place, and sometimes it's easy to, you know, second guess yourself or, you know, do these things, and you don't realize that all of these other companies are going through that every day. And some of the things that you think are like, you know, like, here's your company and you think this problem that happens in one day is like this big, like this giant piece of your company, and it's maybe a speck on the dot, and like it's like a tiny little dot that no one can see that will be erased by lunch. And so
to be replaced by a bigger problem.
To be replaced by a bigger one that might not be replaced for, you know, or that might not be erased for a long time. But I wasn't aware that the program would be so focused on founder growth and health. And for example, every week, a few times a week, they have founder stories and people come in, and these companies that you see, that you hear about, and they're successful and they're growing and everything seems fine and dandy to an outsider. It's the founders are like breaking down inside, and they'll come in and it's like kind of these private dinners, and they tell you everything and they'll cry. I mean, these men are crying and they're going like, this was hard. We almost went out of business 10 times. We thought we would never make it. And so really putting yourself in that position of, or you know, opening yourself up to these other things.
You have to agree to be vulnerable then.
So vulnerable, yeah. And so I think that growth of seeing people going through this and realizing, oh, they're like, oh, you're not getting sued by 1 million people. You're good. I'm like, what do you mean? That's like, I'm, you know, so these things just kind of like change your perspective.
I'm on the verge of personal bankruptcy, but I'm not getting sued, I guess.
Yeah, it's good. They're like, oh, I'm already bankrupt. No, I'm kidding. it made me change my perspective on what actually is a problem and realizing that.
Right. So you're just a problem solving mode.
All the time. And expecting that every day will be problem solved. Like that's what each day is.
So you realize that puts you into the mindset of a trained special forces person. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
that's
SEALs.
What I meant. Yeah, that's what
that's,
I meant.
You know, they break them down.
Yeah.
To build them back up so that they know, okay, try to drown me, try to kill me, try to throw me out of a plane, try, you know, all the crazy things that they have been doing survival training. And it's, you learn how to problem solve and that it's not going to kill you.
Yeah, that's actually a great analogy. I think, you know, the first few weeks are about breaking you down, and they break you down kind of to your bare bones.
So it sounds to me like this was a pretty illuminating experience. And I'm now coming to the point in the story where we start talking about the eye of the hurricane.
Oh, yeah.
The pivot.
The pivot.
So when did you realize, maybe we're going about this in a, we should think about this in a different way. Maybe there's something we're missing. You know, when did you start to like gain that awareness of, oh, we're in pivot land now?
Yeah, well, in the pivot land in this story is interesting because it wasn't a product pivot. It was a positioning pivot and how we're talking about the product and what we do. And to answer your first question of when did I realize that, it was probably the first day. Which was, you know, you're going through this.
Right off the bat.
Yeah, so right off the bat. So part of the process is you go, there are over, I think, 200 meetings within the first 8 days. and you talk about your company in 20 minutes to over 200 people, and you're just going all day, every day, and that's part of the process to make you, they want to train you to talk about your company in the right way and to be able to go all day, every day. Because, surprise, but more than 40 hours a week. So,
so you were happy.
Back to the original job, yeah. So I was excited. And so I walked into a meeting, and I'm, like, thinking, I'm going in, and I'm thinking, oh, we have our, like, BFO marketing, that's what we do, that's who we are, and this is my story, and I'm sticking to it. And so the very first meeting, this man, his name was Joe, and he sits down, and he goes, I've read all about it. Why the hell are you focused on BFO marketing? Like, why is that? Why do you? And I'm just like, what? Like, I'm just.
He was
like,
your first one?
First one. I remember the room that we were sitting in and everything. And I'm like, what do you mean? I was just a deer in headlights. Like, what do I even say after this? And he goes, it seems like that's just a little part of your business. And so I listened. It still didn't click. And I had 199 more meetings to get through. So I kind of stuck to the BFO marketing. And then a few of my mentors throughout the process, over the few months, they kept saying, what you're doing is social. Like, one of the goals was positioning. So how do we go to market? How do we sell this to more and bigger companies? And they kept saying, you're enabling social shopping. This is social commerce. This is, you know, and that's how they were talking about it. And it wasn't clicking. And you'll see that happen sometimes with founders. I think they really have to process it and see it from different angles. And it finally clicked.
So you realized that you were missing an essential component of the marketing, of the BFO marketing, which is what the social aspect of it, right?
Yeah, we were focused on gifting. So we were focused on this act of buying for someone. And when we took a step back, we realized that shopping in itself, so shopping is social and shopping is fun in person. Shopping on a brand's website kind of sucks. It's boring and it's lonely. So it's quite opposite of what shopping in person and what shopping really should be. And so the data that we were collecting and the way that we were engaging users was creating natural, it was naturally creating the social interface that allowed people to shop together on brands' websites.
Okay, so then let's to recap. 2018, you leave Houston, you join RealCo Accelerator Program, you get started, you start talking to your earliest customers, and you apply for Techstars, and you get in.
Right.
2019, you go through Techstars, you and come out the other side of the eye of the hurricane, just realize you're pivoting, releasing a new product this year.
Yes.
Right? And you have 200 mentor meetings in 3 months while you were at Techstars?
In 8 days.
Oh, in 8 days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was Special Forces training right there. Yeah. Wow.
I cried 100 times.
Okay. So then how are you thinking before, and how are you thinking now after, now that you're looking at, you know, making the plans for the product launch and, you know, thinking about the bigger market that that first mentor said you were missing?
Yeah. So I'll kind of talk about, let's see. So before and after Techstars is,
the compare contrast. This is the essay question on the test.
Yeah. So we were focused on this kind of gifting, this buying for other sector before. And the product that we released in November was very much a beta, very much a V1 of what we're building out. And I say, you know, I mentioned earlier that the pivot was really a positioning pivot. Changing our positioning has helped define the rest of our product. It's not that it's changed what we've done, but it's a natural extension of where we were. And it has really opened our eyes to where we're headed and the scalability of the product. And so that's where we're focused right now. We use the word connectivity a lot. We're really not just connecting people, but we're working right now actively. We'll be releasing it this December. On connecting consumer actions across brands.
So it makes me think that perhaps the positioning type of pivot is actually maybe a harder one to undertake than a change in product offering, because it's, I think, more subtle. You have to talk about your positioning and your offerings and your capacity for scaling. So nowadays when people launch a new B2B SaaS company and they say, oh, it's like X for Uber. It's Uber for pet food. It's Uber for vitamin delivery. But you're the first one. You can't say we're like a deer duck, but for so how do you talk about your positioning, your market, how you've created this new market? That's got to be a brave new world, whole another category of founder experience, because not every founder can say I invented my market.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really, really hard. Some of you have probably seen me go through that struggle. The way that we've identified to really work the best for us right now is to kind of paint a picture of the world today and then how that's different. So compare and contrast kind of directly. And I'll give an example that I use pretty often. And it takes a little bit longer than being able to say, you know.
Right, because you can't say, we're like deer duck for buying, okay?
Right.
Just say yes.
Yes. So I normally say, you know, imagine that you book a flight on, you're going on a girls' trip, and you book a flight to Mexico on United or Southwest or, you know, whichever airline. And then you go to Nordstrom, and you click on vacation, dresses, and this is the today world. Vacation dresses, and over 2,000 dresses show up, and you can try this at home tonight. And then you leave Nordstrom's website, you go to Anthropologie or, you know, another retailer, and you repeat the same process. Then you text your friends that are going on the trip. What do you think about this? What do you think about this dress? You know, what are you wearing? And so that's how people would really do that today.
It's a clunky user experience, to say the least.
Oh, yes. It takes forever. It's just rousing. It's frustrating. And we've kind of come to accept it because there's not been another option. And so on the flip side, the way that Deer Duck works is you book a flight to Mexico. We know who you're going with because you've identified this relationship at a different time. You go to Nordstrom and your homepage says 10 days until your trip to Mexico. Based on the weather there and your preferences, here's a curated collection for you. It has your friends within that, so it makes shopping social directly within that collection. So if Iris and I were going to Mexico, I'd say these are things that Iris loves for the trip or that she would love based on her preferences.
Tequila.
Easy.
I'll figure that out.
And then you leave Nordstrom and you go to Anthropologie and you have the exact same experience. Based on your preferences.
I want that.
It's coming soon.
I can't wait. I do want that. And I think we've all experienced that. No, think about, all right, so guys, right? Because you're like, oh, dresses. Oh, I can't get into it. Yoga pants. All right, so car parts. You're a car enthusiast. And it's like, hey, look at this cool gizmo. I lack the vocabulary. Look at this cool gizmo to like jazz up my sports car so that I can take it out to the track. Do you think this one or maybe this other one? This one is cheaper, but this one gives me more stuff.
Right? Well, and a lot of times when I meet with investors, they go, you know, well, I don't really shop for clothes with friends. And then I go,
yes, you
well,
do.
I know, right?
You do.
They do. And so I say, well, what about, you know, whiskey? Or do you fish or do you golf or do you do these things? And their mind just goes
parts,
like this.
Car parts.
I'll try that one.
But get better vocabulary.
Yeah, I'll try.
Okay, so, you know, it's funny because I've talked to founders about service or product pivots. And they say, oh, there wasn't a market for my product, but I realized that there was a market for a different part of the product. And so we focused on building that instead of this. With the positioning pivot, what advice would you give founders? Because that really is a very subtle and yet very deep way of looking at your business model and your business approach, especially since you're creating a market and figuring out how to approach this market.
Yeah.
It's hard. How do you, I mean, is there, and you're still kind of still in the midst of it. So is there any, maybe one lesson learned from dealing with and surviving a positioning pivot as a founder?
I think being so open to the way that people perceive your product. I was, and I'll kind of use the BFO marketing or the, you know, as an example, that, well, we have a list of kind of pieces that fall under the umbrella of the industry that we're creating, and that will be one of them, but that's, you know, 5% of what we do. And so it seemed so certain at the time. And so being open to the feedback that you're getting, and realizing too that you might not, just because it seems like someone isn't getting your product, they might be actually opening your eyes to something that you're just not seeing.
So would you also say that's the benefit you got from Techstars?
That's a big benefit, yeah.
That they made you, especially it was how interesting that it was the very first interview that you had.
It started with the first, and then I started seeing a few patterns. Yeah.
So the reaction from hearing it the first time was like, no, I'm going to stick with this too. Like, well, when you heard it the eighth or ninth time, then you're thinking, oh.
Yeah, I was hearing different little, like, different chunks of, like, you know, advice across throughout the process. And so I was just like, social commerce, like, it's not even a thing, you know, like, I don't know. Like, and so being able to, it took me a little while and to kind of absorb that.
Well, it seems like you really got maximum benefit from the experience.
Yeah, I did. It was great.
So in terms of finding mentors along the way, you know, the journey of a founder starts with, you know, a coffee and a stack of research papers, right? And
please don't do that. That's
well,
the advice.
You know, you got to get your start somewhere. And then, you know, in your extreme example of, you know, 200 mentors talking to you in 8 days. So somewhere in between those two extremes for an early stage founder who's trying to figure out, I'm trying to do this. How can I reach out to mentors? How can I find the mentors that I need at this particular stage of my journey? It sounds to me like you were pretty proactive in finding this woman who would understand the research because she did it.
Yeah, you have to be proactive. I think too, looking back, I had no clue what the startup ecosystem was in 2015. I didn't understand this world at all. And so I was doing things without realizing it. You know, I was reaching out to people and asking for advice for things that I didn't even know I needed advice on. I didn't know that raising money was even a real thing. Like, you know, I thought I maybe needed $20,000, which I wasn't worried about, you know. So I think just being proactive and not being afraid. You have the interesting thing about startups that I've learned, you can't be embarrassed. You can't be like worried about anything. Like 99% of the time, you're going to have no idea what you're doing. And you just have to kind of go with it and not worry about what anyone else may think when you're asking questions. They were probably in your shoes at some point.
And so I was going to ask you this at the beginning, but then we started talking about the pivot and the eye of the hurricane. And well, you know, that just seems so much more pressing.
Yeah.
Why Deer Duck? That's an interesting name for a startup. Deer Duck?
Yeah.
Why?
I have to say this story. I was born in Louisiana, and it sounds like for anyone that's from Louisiana, if they don't actually see the company's name, they think that it's an actual deer and a duck. And they're like, oh, this is a hunting company. So thank you for asking.
So it's not hunting.
It's not a hunting name. But we were looking for, so our mission is to strengthen relationships and to connect people by helping them learn more about each other. And so the word dear is how you start a letter. It's a form of how you begin an interaction or a connection with someone. It's also a term of endearment. The word duck dates back to Shakespearean time. It's a British term for someone that you love. And it's a little quirky. I'm a little quirky, so combine the two.
So ducky would be appropriate?
Yeah.
Ducky, ducky, ducky. I'm sorry, I had to. Okay, so we got some great audience questions. Can you talk about creating the marketing and publicity pieces of Deer Duck?
Yeah, and just to be, I'm constantly kind of navigating this road because we are, you know, on the cusp of the marketing piece for businesses. So how we're marketing to get more businesses in the funnel, but also we're boosting the marketing for our partners. And so really making sure that they're using our tool appropriately for and how they're marketing it. And so because it is new, that's been a big piece of the puzzle that we've been figuring out. So to date, we've actually been working on high touch sales. And so we're building relationships with a few what we would call lighthouse customers, people that will be fully implementing DeerDuck within their company. So we really haven't been hyper-focused on marketing to date, but that will start coming in next year.
If you could redo any part of your entrepreneurial journey, what would you have done differently?
Oh.
You would not have taken the stack of research papers to the coffee date.
But maybe I would. I don't know.
But maybe it you would. That's quirky. Like, that makes you you.
Yeah. You know, I try. This is an interesting question because one of the pieces of advice that I have for a lot of founders is that you can't wish that you would have done something else. You act in the moment a lot of times, and as much as you try to plan or you try to do things, you just can't all the time. You're learning so fast that as long as you're paying attention to what you're learning and changing. So I try not to regret things or try not to, you know, wish that I would have made another decision. I think if I would have gone back in time, I wish I would have launched a B2B product before a consumer product. But I don't know that we would have been as successful at launching the product that we did without all of those learnings.
Because the learnings is part of the journey, part of the process, right? And you have the deeper understanding as a result.
Right.
Right. So in other words, you don't know how your carburetor works. See, it's a guy example. You don't know how your carburetor works until you have to take the darn thing apart and rebuild it because you don't have the instruction sheet.
Exactly, right. So I would have either changed everything I did or nothing.
right, exactly. Okay, so what in your early education or even your childhood prepared you for your journey in becoming a CEO? Look back into the dark recesses of your mind. Did you maybe try to sell things when you were a child?
I did try to sell things. So that's I'll talk about my first job. What I was processing is I'm wondering if anything could ever prepare you to be a CEO.
Or education-wise, were there any courses where it's nothing. In other words, college debt, don't bother with
don't
it.
Bother with college.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm kidding. When I was about 5 years old, I had a speech impediment, so I'll tell you the full story. I had this speech impediment and I couldn't say Katie, so my name was Tady, if anyone asked. And I started Tady's Garden Clubs or Tady's Garden Tours at my grandmother's house, and I would charge $1 for a garden tour, and I would bring a notebook with me. And I would want, and like, it felt like the garden was the size of this room, but it was probably half the size of this like stage area. It was tiny. I would just kind of watch like what everyone was pointing out. So I couldn't spell very well. And as an example, my mom's page had like a number 2 and a pair of lips and a pink crayon. And that meant that she loved pink tulips. So I would kind of like store all of these data points in my notebook from the garden tours that I was charging $1 for. And then I would charge my dad, my uncles, and people $1 throughout the year to look in the notebook for people's favorite things. And what was interesting about that is we were thinking through a pricing model, and there was more thought that went into this because it actually made sense at one point. This isn't the pricing model we're going with, but I said, what about $1 a user a month? Because that's what I charged when I was 5. So that was kind of a joke that we've come back to a few times.
So when you were in Houston, could you have predicted that looking into 2020, you'd be doing what you're doing now? So when you were in Houston, what did you think you would be doing in 3 years?
So part of that...
Because it's different
than
what you're doing.
So I think I still have one of these, and Marcy probably does actually. Part of this stack of research that I had, on the top of the stack, there was a 60-page laminated business plan, not even a deck. It was a business plan. And
laminated.
It was laminated.
I'm impressed.
I spent so much money on laminating that. That's what I would change.
Not worth the money. Okay.
I looked back at the digital file of that actually probably a month ago, and the very last page of this 60-page deck thing, not deck, business plan. It said, imagine a world where, and there was a little search bar, and it had an example of someone typing in someone's name. And it showed what they love. It showed their preferences. And at that time, I had no idea what that meant. I didn't realize that that is exactly what we're doing today.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So I had no idea I would be here because I didn't understand what that meant. But when I look back and I see our pivots and I see where we've gotten...
You're creating a way to do that.
We're creating a way to do that. And it's hard and it takes time and it's not easy creating a new industry or new market, you know, segment. So
because you can't say, we're like deer duck.
Yeah. And I didn't even know what something. Like a startup was. So I mean, I kind of did, but you know, I didn't know those things. So having to learn all of those things to be able to build the company that we're building today has been, you know, part of the process that I want to change.
So you shared with us from your laminated business plan back in Houston.
At the registry club.
Right. Well, but that's okay, you know. Yeah. And so, all right, last question. What does that laminated virtual page look like now? Now that you've gone through the eye of the hurricane and you've gotten all of this deep understanding from what you've been through so far, you're looking ahead to 2020 and beyond. What do you think that page would say now? The same or something maybe a little different?
It says something different. It says, you know,
can you tell us?
I can. We see, so the future of Deer Duck is really the future of e-commerce. Yeah.
I'm so excited. You heard it here first.
And so that is how we explain what we're doing. We really see Deer Duck being the future of e-commerce, and we use these humanized kind of moments of why we even buy what we buy. You know, we buy things to do with people and to do things in our lives. And so we really we've had to focus on, you know, where does that thing that you're doing initiate and how does that connect to commerce and who are these people? And so by doing that, we've been able to very much simplify the future of that.
That's incredible. Well, I hope we have your questions answered. Are you feeling inspired now?
Well, and even back, so we released the first product and then we sold to a new customer and then to a new customer. And the users started saying, wait a minute, how do I apply this, like my preferences, what I like to this other retailer? How do I see someone else's preferences? Or, you know, I'm going on this trip, how do I do this? And so we started seeing kind of the natural behavior of what they were doing and the questions they were asking. I think for us, we have to think of users in the form of consumers who are using the product from a brand's, you know, website or those things. But on the other side, also looking at brands as users and how are they talking about it. And I've probably gone to 100 meetings with my customers just to listen. I don't talk in a lot of those. I just asked if I could tag along to their exec meetings and, you know, these meetings where and see how they're naturally talking about the product. And I realized like some of the ways that our customers talk about Deer Duck is automated curation. They don't have to curate anymore because these preferences and social networks are doing it for them. So it's driven a lot.
So in other words, you know, you create the wish list on Amazon, you have the saves on Instagram that's messy, it's all over the internet, it's bits and pieces, and that's only your preferences.
Right.
It doesn't reflect anybody else's preferences.
Well, it's not even your preferences. It's
things that catch my eye.
Like it's a thing at a point in time, right?
Right. But it's not, no, let me search through all the things for you and show you something you may not know that will be perfect for someone that you like spending money on.
Yeah.
And you need to.
Right. Or like, what if I wanted to dress like I, like, it's like, so that was another piece of, that actually was a huge piece of realizing people, that was when the shift kind of started becoming that social piece, is people are influenced by, you know, how would, we call it a filter, like how would, what would Iris's shopping filter be like? And it layers on my preferences too. So shopping and filters and things and to get someone's inspiration started becoming a natural.
So is there, has anyone raised any concerns about, oh, I don't think I want you to know that much about me?
No.
I mean, I think it's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. And we purposely choose certain categories. So we don't choose, you know, categories that people might be embarrassed of, or, you know, and it's direct data. So it's not, because it's like you'll start noticing this. So whenever you go to a dinner party or, you know, you're with people at work and they'll start talking about, oh, my favorite type of tea or my favorite, you know, like these like very detailed interest, that's kind of the natural conversation that typically starts happening. People don't really talk as much about like one particular pair of shoes or brand or tea, you know, so they like to talk about and express who they are in the detailed layer. So we've actually seen it be a positive.
Wow, no, that's really exciting.
I always joke, I'm like, when are you not fundraising as a startup? We are opening a round of funding within the next 4 weeks. So we've been doing a lot of prep on that front.
So that was one of my wrap-up question, which is like, what are you planning for in the near future? So you're looking at opening up another round of funding.
Yeah, we're opening a round of funding, you know, within the month. And we are using that to grow our team. And we made 3 hires in the last week. And then we have a couple of other hires that will be coming on board, but we're kind of positioning that, you know, as we close this round, then that'll be kind of the trigger for them to come on. When we go through user testing, and I've been torn on this as a founder, because a lot of users, they say, oh, this would be really fun to be able to shop in an influencer's filter on any brand's website. Like, you know, how would they shop for their fall vacation or do these things? And so there is a business opportunity for us to lead with that with certain brands. We're talking to Nordstrom about that actually this week. And but we kind of have to, you know, really think through, is that what we would want to lead with? Because it would be an initial, you know, great opportunity for us to boost our user base and to grow quickly with the brands. But at the same time, it's a little bit, it's not directly aligned with our mission of individual connections. And is that okay? We'll see.
Okay, final question. I'm a big believer.
Oh, I'm like,
that the universe is a generous place.
It is a very generous place.
But you have to make the ask. You have to let the universe know what it is you're looking for, right? Like, you know, your favorite brand of tea.
Right.
So what is a wish that you have that you would like to have granted between now and, say, the end of the year or early spring next year? What's a wish you have?
Just one.
Top one. Don't get greedy. Universe is listening. One or two big asks. What would you like to ask for?
I think my biggest ask is, you know, I mentioned that we've made these great hires. I believe that a team is everything. I think I've really leaned into my mentors and they've made such a difference in everything. But there are a couple of mentors right now that we are working very closely with who would potentially be joining our team. And so that is probably a big wish. Yeah, that's dependent on fundraising and a few other things falling into place.
That's a big wish. I hope you get it.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
I do too.
Well, I want to take the time to thank you and to thank Geekdom and to thank everyone in the audience for coming out tonight. I hope you got to learn some interesting things, and you heard it first. The future of e-commerce is sitting right here. Katie.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Iris, and thank you all for coming.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode. Be sure to check out geekdom.com for more information about the Geekdom Fireside Chat series, other Geekdom events, and membership opportunities. Look for Geekdom on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.